Hello.
Oh, hi, Paul.
Hello, John. Hi. Right, I'll crack straight on with things. I'm Paul Scott, a full-time investor in small caps, and I'm talking today to John MacArthur, the CEO of Traxys, ticker TRCS. A few quick disclaimers. This audio cast is just for information only. It's not a recommendation or financial advice. Interestingly, though, the questions have not been prearranged, so John hasn't got a clue what I'm going to ask him. I'm a potential investor, but I do not currently hold shares in Traxys. And also, please note that I am charging a fee, which might affect my objectivity, although I will try my best not to let it. Okay, let's crack on then, John. Welcome.
Hi, Paul.
The results for year ending 31st of July 2014 were published this morning. Figures very good. Do you want to recap on the key figures?
Yeah, you've probably got them in front of you, but revenue was up to 22.4 million. Last year was 10.8. Adjusted EBITDA was up, 60% to just over 5.5 million. Profit before tax is 4.2. Our cash balance rose by 2 and a bit million in the year to just shy of 9 million or 8.9 million. And there was also a dividend that was, well, we've got a progressive, albeit small dividend of 0.8p per share.
Right, okay. Yeah, because I noticed the cash figure works out at nearly 34 pence per share. So it's sort of close to 10% of the share price is actually net cash, isn't it?
That's right. We made an acquisition in the year, which shareholders sort of will appreciate, but we funded and paid for that off the balance sheet. So had we not made that deal, the cash balances would actually be a couple of million higher than that.
Okay. I've just got a quick query on the earnings per share as well, because you reported 12.9 pence basic earnings per share, and I've run through the numbers. And that's a completely clean number in terms of it being sort of statutory basic EPS after all costs, isn't it? Whereas I noticed that the WH Ireland forecast was for 14.9 or 15p per share, but I'm presuming that must be subject to some adjustments. So what's the comparative figure, if you like?
I do have the reconciliation not in front of me, but I knew I was going to get asked that this week. And the two things, our EPS number comes up just above the Ireland's one, but the Ireland's number adds back various things. They've got a slightly weird way of doing it, which rather annoyingly doesn't tie to the way that we report an annual report. But if you do the reconciliation, which I'm very happy to share, albeit I don't have it in front of me, those two figures match. They're very much in line with each other.
So it was in line with expectations. And
it's actually slightly above it, but it's looking here.
Good. The dividends, I noticed, I think I know what the answer is going to be, but I noticed it was covered about 19 times. So with such a cash-rich balance sheet, I know you are being progressive with the dividends, but is there not a case for really pushing the boat out and paying a much bigger divvy?
I'm sure there is, and I'm open to thoughts on this. The truth of the matter is we're a growth company. If we paid a 5% yield dividend or whatever, you'd get accused of being an ex-growth company that was boring, and we'd pick up a totally different slew of institutional shareholders. We started paying it so that we could, I suppose, for two reasons. One was because we deliberately wanted to create financial discipline and to show people that we were serious, and also so that we didn't end up sort of sitting in front of institutional investors and say, oh, well, you're not a real company because you don't pay a dividend. I don't know what the right answer is. We want to be able to maintain cash levels that allow us to continue to grow via acquisition, because we've been pretty successful at that to date, whilst at the same time hopefully getting another tick in the box for paying a dividend. But I completely appreciate that it's not interesting if you're sort of out for yield stocks. Could we increase it? Absolutely. I don't know. There's arguments for sort of not paying one.
Yeah, pro and con. Yeah. I mean, the other thing I was thinking about, in a way, perhaps it's better for you to pay a small divvy and not do placings when you want to make acquisitions. Because, you know, I noticed that you haven't really issued that many shares at all. I think it's that the share count is up about 30% over the last 5 years or something. So I'm sure,
correct,
you know, if I were a shareholder, I would like the fact that I'm not being diluted by you issuing shares to institutions at a 5 or 10% discount periodically.
We're extremely grippy about dilution. We've only ever raised, I think I'm right in saying, we've only ever raised £3.95 million on AIM, which is tiny. And we've made 6 acquisitions, paid for in full, and I've got close to £9 million cash in the bank.
We would never.
It would be pointless paying out the cash and then having to go back to shareholders and do a placing for a deal.
Yes, no, that makes sense. In terms of the 6 acquisitions you've done, are you happy with them all, or are there any you wished you hadn't done?
I'm happy with all of them. Our brokers, WH Ireland, and one of the notes that I'm sure you and your readers will be able to get their hands on is an analysis of how each one's performed. I mean, all of the 6 companies that we've bought have been profitable, because that's one of our investment sort of criteria. They have to be profitable. They were all hugely accretive, and they're all paid for in full. So they've all performed to varying levels. One of the ones that we bought in 2011 was a real home run, but all of them were accretive, and I'm happy with all of them.
Okay, because I was looking at your website, and it sets out very specifically your acquisition criteria, even with a worked example, which I thought was very open way of doing it. And it was emphasising that you want companies that consistently make profits, rather than you wouldn't buy presumably something loss making because of growth expectations, would you?
We haven't today, and I don't know how you go about valuing something like that. And we're not, the acquisitions that we make are not turnaround companies. The idea is that the deal has to stand up on its own merits. So even if it carries on trading exactly as it has done in the past with no growth, there should be a huge arbitrage opportunity from taking a good, well-run private company and sticking it onto a public market with liquidity and following that comes with that. However, the reality has been that the last 6 deals that we've done, they've also had a bit of a cross-sell, upsell opportunity. So there has been, I think in every single one, well, I know in every single one of the companies that we've bought, they have grown, whilst at the same time being immediately accretive.
That sort of leads into my next question, actually. I was going to ask you whether there's much synergy between the acquisitions and whether you hands-on manage the companies, or is it sort of 6 completely separate businesses doing their own thing?
No, for a long time we had, I think what I referred to as a sort of 5-legged spider. So we did have individual trading companies, their own P&L, their own budget, their own management team. Over the years, and especially in the last 18 months, we've now formalised things into we've got 3 divisions. So we've got a FinOps software division, we've got an RCM, remote condition monitoring business, which is a standalone business, and then we've got a data capture and an analytics business. So we've got 3 divisions, and we split them out in the annual report so that people can see how each one has done. And each of the acquisitions that we've done to date and the pipeline that we're looking at going forward naturally fits within those 3 divisions. Largely to do with the customer base. So software and RailOps is all to do with transport operators. The RCM business is infrastructure, so it's a different client set, a different market. And likewise, the data capture and analytics business tend to be completely different customers. So we manage those divisions separately. Each one has its own MD, and each one has got its own P&L and budget.
Okay. Would you take on any debt if the right deal came along?
We were asked this just about 10 minutes ago in the analyst presentation. I'm not averse to taking on debt, but I don't really see it in our future. The business chucks off more cash every year than we've been able to spend. We would like to do larger deals. We would probably like to increase the frequency of the deals that we do. So whilst I'm not averse to taking on debt, I see no need for it in the foreseeable future.
Okay. I mean, we've had quite a few questions in from readers, but I thought it would be good to make it interactive, and I posted on several bulletin boards to ask people to submit questions, and there's been quite a lot
Sure.
of interest. Most of it, in fact, nearly all of it, seems to focus on your condition monitoring business, which seems to be
Yes.
the sort of jewel in the crown, I think, of the group. I mean, can you just describe that in layman's terms, what its products are?
Yeah, we have novel hardware and associated software that is looking to, we monitor critical railway assets, things like points, point motors, level crossings, overhead electrical equipment. And what we're doing is capturing in real time the electrical heartbeat of that motor as it trips from left to right or up and down. And the so what in all this is that if you're looking at the signal from each one of those bits of kit in real time, you can then apply regression and heuristics and look at just simply the current being drawn against time, and then you can predict failure before it happens. So the idea is by capturing data in real time from critical assets, you can look at the signal that's coming back and hopefully try and predict when it's going to fail. And the so what from that is that if you're an infrastructure owner or a railroad, you can actually replace and maintain your operation before you've incurred the hardship of actually having kit fail, which best case scenario, it's a delay, so a train or a vehicle that's stuck at faulty infrastructure. Worst case scenario, it could be a derailment or a pantograph coming off the top of a train or whatever. So there's a safety aspect to it, but predominantly it's a cost saving and a performance saving. So reduced delays and reduced costs for maintenance.
Okay.
Is that layman? I'm not sure if that's layman.
Yeah,
enough.
No. I followed that. Well, most of it anyway. moving on to some specific questions about the condition monitoring business, and I appreciate that maybe some of these you may want to skirt around if they're commercially sensitive, but Reggie asks, how much of the UK market has been satisfied for remote monitoring? So is the scale of your opportunity increasing or not?
I suppose that depends on what you want to monitor. So without trying to sort of skirt around the question, some of the specific applications for our technology are sort of halfway through their total addressable market, but that is in a market that is growing. So as the appetite for the concept of remote condition monitoring for fault prediction is adopted, so too are the applications. So to begin with, we only really monitored things like points and point motors. Now we're talking about a variety of other applications. So it really depends what you're looking at. We see it as being a growth market, although I suppose critically within the UK, there is a finite size of railway. And the real growth plan for that division is to find and work with more railroads, and that's what we've done to some extent in the last 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, that's another area that I think that really jumped out of the page for me when I was reading your results today was the North American pilots, which I think you announced initially in about almost a year ago, and then the trial was extended again, wasn't it? And I mean, there was one phrase, I forget where it is in today's figures, where you say, well, here we are, the considerable market opportunity in America, many times larger than what we have achieved thus far within the UK. Now, that's got everyone interested. So perhaps you could expand on that?
Well, it's fairly simple, really. We're working with, last November, I think it was, and then subsequently we updated the market in June or July. We were lucky enough to win our first US client, so it's a major Class 1 railway. We haven't disclosed the client's name, but they're big. And to give you an idea of the size of their network, it's bigger in track miles than the whole of the UK. So it's a huge infrastructure. It's fair to say their environment isn't as intensive as what you'd find in the UK. So there is less things to monitor, but it's still a really important client. And so that client has adopted the technology. It's currently in sort of testing phase, if you like. They've got 11 sites, and we would expect or anticipate that to grow over time. And where we're up to now is that we're now in discussions with other big railroads and transit authorities for the same technology, for the same sort of application. So it's a big market. What I can't predict at the moment is the specific adoption cycle in terms of, you know, how far we'll get, how quickly. Each client is different, and each client has to justify and prove the payback period, which is well established in the UK, very well established. So we'll see. I'm very pleased about where we've got to in a relatively short period of time, because we only met the client or our technology partner last August, and by November, that was when we RNS'd the pilot. So long may it continue.
Yeah, okay. And on a similar vein, Hereford Dave from Twitter asks about the USA as well. He says, will this require a larger than UK admin function in infrastructure to support sales in America?
No, it requires no admin function. So we carry out all of the work in the US via a technology partner. We haven't named that technology partner, but it's a business that we started working with last year, and I was over in the States 2 months ago with the MD of our RCM division. And what we've got in place at the moment is a straightforward reseller agreement. So the company that we work with is a company that looks and smells a little bit like Traxys. They do software and hardware for various control aspects of freight railroads. So they're an interesting business. They saw our kit and really wanted to market it to their client base, and their client base is all the major Class 1 railroads. And what we've got in place at the moment is a straightforward reseller agreement where they have guaranteed, or they've agreed to delivering X number of units per year, and whilst they're delivering, we'll be happy to work with them. If at any point they fall behind the curve and we think, well, actually, we could do this faster if we had boots on the ground in the States, we do that. But our experience to date is that going through a technology intermediary that's already got an established customer base, and it's domestic people speaking to domestic people, Americans speaking to Americans, is the best way to do it.
Yes, yes, okay. And then Stewie18 from ADVFN has asked about 8 or 9 questions, which I think is a bit indulgent. So I'll just pick one or two of the best ones here. he's saying, what sort of contribution, I think he means to turnover, can we expect regarding MPEX sales in US for next year? Brackets, rest of the world sales were only $382,000 this year. So is there going to be much of a step up, do you think?
The short answer is we don't know. So a couple of years ago, we had no revenue outside of the UK. In the last 12 months, we've got fairly significant revenue from Ireland. And we, now that we've got our seat firmly on the table with one client in the US, the great unknown is how fast we will be able to reference our success with that client and cross-sell, upsell to the rest of the market. Our experience within the UK has been that the market for technology that works is very self-referencing, because it's the no one gets fired for buying IBM type analogy. The initial client's always the hardest to knock over, and then once you get them, provided that they're a respected reference case, you can sort of buy access to other clients. So I can't really answer that question. We have forecast in the market at the moment, but I wouldn't want to go into specifics on exactly what we expect to get.
Fair point. He also asks, have there been any other international pilots for the condition monitoring equipment?
We've got, like I said, we don't make a big thing of it in the accounts, but there's a fair footprint in Ireland, and I'll be surprised if we don't announce other successful contract wins this financial year outside of the UK. We're currently tendering for various bits of work in Australia, and we'll RNS. We'll update the market as and when those things convert.
Yeah. The final question from Stewie, because we've been very generous with him. He says, will you have issues supplying the product en masse if you get big overseas orders?
I don't think so. I mean, I suppose it depends what the magnitude of the order is. It's a nice problem to have. The way that we see the overseas market at the moment and the prospects that we've got is that we would do it via reseller partnership agreements. So we've got a presence in Australia that can help us distribute in terms of that market. The US, as I mentioned, we've already got a partner there. In the UK, we subcontract all the manufacturing of our devices to a third party.
So the manufacturer is in Britain, but by a sort of large contract manufacturer.
That's right. They're absolutely fantastic. They will even hold stock for us that we'd have to pay for, and on a sort of call-down basis, and they've been fantastic. So it's meant that the core kernel of our RCM team has remained in software development and hardware development. So it's all sort of the innovation bit. All of the actual manufacturing is outsourced. And at the moment, when we're delivering kit abroad, it's all done from the UK.
Okay.
That might change, but at the moment, I think we envisage it to be able to all be done by the UK.
Right, okay. And Medlar 33, which I think is from Stockopedia, asks how the Traxys offerings compare with those of Trapeze Group in North America and Atos Rail Division in the UK and Europe.
Within the UK and Europe, we work fairly closely with Atos. So it used to be Atos Origin. They inherited a lot of the old BR systems when it was privatised. It's fair to say that a lot of our kit is linked to some of the Atos systems. They tend to be more database systems that hold data. We take data out of it, do clever things, and then squirt the answer back into those mainframe systems. But there's very little overlap in terms of competitive tensions with Atos. With regards to Trapeze, it's fair to say that some of our products are competitive with them, but Trapeze tend to have their roots in bus and not rail, and railway is a much harder problem. So we tend not to compete with them. We don't actively look at doing or winning bus companies. We do work with First Group, which I think are still the largest passenger bus service operator in the UK. They've got about 10,000 or 9,000 odd buses, which all use our bus tracks scheduling software. But our strategy, if you like, our growth plans is to remain focused on the really difficult problems in heavy rail. And Trapeze, if you look at their own website, they typically focus on bus and metro services rather than heavy rail. And that's sort of backed up by the evidence in terms of I don't think Trapeze have any UK installations with rail operating companies.
Okay. That sort of ties in, actually, with our final question from John the Tourist, which is from Motley Fool, and he's asked, how large is the opportunity in infrastructure as opposed to rail? But I think you've half answered that really already.
In terms of RCM or software?
He didn't specify, unfortunately.
I think there's this. When people talk about infrastructure, I suppose they're really talking about network rail or abroad, people that look after the infrastructure, the tracks and the stuff that's bolted to the ground. We do very little at the moment with infrastructure providers on a software basis. Is it an opportunity? Absolutely. Network Rail are a huge company that probably has more problems than the owning groups in terms of sort of ops management type problems. So yes, it's an opportunity. Have we got around to sizing it or looking at it? No, being honest, because we just don't have the, or we haven't found the time yet. But yes, there's an opportunity there.
Okay, excellent. I think we're pretty much out of time now, John. So is there any sort of final closing remarks that you'd like to make?
No, not really. I think hopefully people will look at the numbers and shareholders will be pleased about what we've done last year. We tried with the announcement and annual report to sort of reiterate the fact that Traxys is an organic growth story coupled with an aggregation play. The forecasts, obviously, and I know I've already had correspondence with some of your readers about this, the forecasts always lag behind the aggregation bit, but the cash on the balance sheet, that's going to get used for. That's what we've done in the past, and we've done that to fairly good effect. So going forward, we plan to sort of have good growth, organic growth, coupled with disciplined allocation of the cash that's on the balance sheet.
Okay, excellent. Actually, I've got one comment here. John, a tourist, at the end of his email said, "Oh, and please thank John for the growth to date. Much appreciated." So you've got one happy shareholder there. So,
one happy shareholder. Great. I'm happy. Okay. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Paul.
Thanks, John. That was great. Cheers now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.